Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
It's Wednesday, the 22nd of January.
Coming up today, ahead of the Six Nations Championship, we hear from Ireland's new captain, Johnny Sexton.
Oz is going to pick who he thinks is best for the job, and that's what makes it probably more special for me, is that he thought it was me, and now I want to repay him and do a good job.
We catch up with the stars of tomorrow from the Republic of Ireland under-15 soccer team.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. For example, Troy Parra, I'm looking at him getting into the first team of Tottenham and all for a few games. He's unbelievable, he is. And I just hopefully I can follow in his tracks to go and do the same what he's doing.
And the Wednesday legend in studio is an all-star camogie player from a famous Wexford family.
Ball inside towards Ursula Jacob. Can she do it again? Oh! Magnificent! That's unreal! Wow, what a shot from Ursula Jacob!
Go on, Ursula. All that and much more between now and 8 o'clock. Text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn on 2FM.
Marie, how are you doing?
I am flying it today.
Yeah, I'm. Do you know, when we chat about the bubble and being inside the camp and stuff, this is a day I used to always love in Irish camp when they announced when the captain and the coach used to head off. So that's what's happened today. There was a press day.
So today it was the launch of the Six Nations, and the media, the rugby media, descend on wherever it is, and they have free rein with the captains and the head coaches of all the countries that are partaking. So you'll see now that news outlets, websites, tomorrow newspapers will all be flooded with quotes from the main men.
You must love it as media.
Well, it's the one time you actually kind of, you just get around to everyone. So like when you're covering Ireland, you end up just looking at the same people all the time. So at least when you're heading off to a big day, when everybody's at it, you get, you know, your chance to go around and meet different players from different countries. And the other thing as well that's good about it is that when you're covering a country, you always nearly go to the same place, so everyone's in their comfort zone. But when they're being brought to England or wherever the launch is on, everyone's a little bit out of their comfort zone, so they might be on edge a bit.
There's no hiding places. But the one that's killing me for the lads, Wednesday's always a day off in camp. It's the day you kind of head in town, or you might go out. Malcolm O'Kelly used to make a point of keeping an eye on the Colchis that we didn't get knocked down by the Lewis. It was always a Tuesday or a Thursday was the launch day. So the coach and the captain would then head off. And it felt like, you know, when you're in school and the teacher lets you know, I won't be there Friday, and there's a sub teacher coming in, and there's the giddiness, like, and he's there. I will be watching training, lads, and whoever's taking the session, say, Les, kiss, and you're all there like, yeah, but we're not going to get in trouble for dropping balls. So there is the excitement of it. But
I don't know what that says about you.
Do you know the giddiness I'm on about?
Yeah. Like, it was even better though when your teacher just wasn't in and you got to go into another class.
Oh,
they were
remember
the best days.
9:10 and no sign of them, and you were like, no way, today's the day.
Where am I going to end up? Who am I going to see? And it was brilliant then if you saw a brother or sister. You were thrilled.
You were, yeah. I was in Alton's class for the afternoon, delighted with myself. I never told you that before. In primary school, because I had a big arse, I always had a seat bigger than what I was. You know the way they're in junior infants they're red, and then senior infants they're blue, and there was always like a blue chair in senior infants for my tush.
So even at that age?
Yeah, I was a big old unit.
It followed you around everywhere.
I was a giant Monchichi, it was pretty much it. Yeah, I've always struggled to get my arse into a chair, so I don't know how we ended up here.
I don't know where we're going to go from here. Maybe Johnny Sexton, he was out today as captain.
First run out as skips, and yeah, he had an awful lot to say. And it's good to, you know, to get Johnny in this role. If media think they're going to, you know, sorry, look at me getting all defensive, and because the lines are there now, aren't
Ooh.
They?
Yeah, you're still not quite in the media.
But I don't think he's the fella that will play ball and just roll over and give sound bites.
Well, that's good though. You want someone to actually tell you what they feel and tell you what you're thinking.
I don't think he'll do that either.
Well, will we hear from him?
Yeah, let's do it.
Something that I probably secretly wanted someone to want me to do it. Faz has obviously been that person. Yeah, it's not something that you ever, you know, think you should have. It's something that you want someone else to think. And it's a huge honour, massive privilege. And, you know, from family, for anyone that knows me, for, you know, being associated with me over the years. And, yeah, it's come late, but better late than never. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, you know, for however long it lasts, we'll have a bit of success.
And I'd imagine it's probably the shortest thought process of your life when the phone call or the conversation comes to ask you if you're willing to take on the role.
Yeah, I wanted it to be right, though. I said to Faz, you know, if you want to go with James or, you know, someone younger, or you want to go with Pete, like, I'll get behind them, you know what I mean? I think I have with the other previous captains, and I've learned a hell of a lot from them, great captains that I've played under. So, yeah, I would have had no arguments, you know, because Faz is going to pick who he thinks is best for the job, and that's what makes it probably more special for me, is that he thought it was me, and now I want to repay him and do a good job.
With the role that you play within the team, and even just the simplicity of the position you play, does it change how you prepare for a match at all, or is it just one added responsibility that doesn't really change how vocal you would be or how you try to lead the team from your role?
Yeah, like there's some small intricacies that have to change. Obviously, there's going to be a little bit more of talking to you guys.
You say that as if it's
once,
a bad thing.
Once a week. So there's a little bit of that. There's obviously certain meetings that as a captain you run, and you have to see the bigger picture more, whereas before I allowed Rory to do that and helped Rory with that, but very much had to concentrate on myself. Now I've got to sort of factor in everyone, be the link between the players and Faz, and be the link between the players and the leadership group, and make sure that everything has been passed up there. And the way Faz wants to go with it, it's going to be more player driven. We did have a strong voice with Joe. I know a lot's been made of different things over the last while, but Joe had a leadership group and relied heavily on them. But Faz wants to take that a step further. So, yeah, the big responsibility there to make it work, but we're going to do it together.
Looking at the landscape, like plenty of new faces around the squad, plenty of guys gunning to make a first international appearance or consolidate their place, new coaching structure. So there must be great energy around the camp, I'd imagine, just to bringing all that together, a sense of freshness, a sense of a new start.
Yeah, it's massive, yeah. Like, all the guys come into any campaign, like, eager to impress, and obviously then when you've got a lot of young guys coming in, and guys, even the guys that aren't young or fresh, they're keen to put things right and to make sure we get back to being a really successful team, playing really well, and Faz has got some good ideas, Cathy's come in and had some good ideas, and it's up to us now to drive things together and to improve things.
And when you look at some of those young guns, say the Leinster contingent that are going into the Six Nations uncapped, like, these players are so ready for the step up and everything, much younger in their careers than maybe players were in the past.
Honestly, I mean, it's hard to know. You never know, because international rugby is so different. And, you know, if we're going well as a team, when a new guy comes in, it'll allow him to look good and to play well. You know what I mean? You know, there wasn't too many new guys that came in last year when the team wasn't playing well that really shone, you know what I mean? Whereas in 18, there was a load of them, and it's which comes first? Is it new guys coming in that spurred us, or is it us playing well that allowed them to shine? It's a mixture of both, really, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about being together and driving things together and being a good environment for new people to come into and a place where people want to be.
There's so much change across the landscape in terms of coaches, in terms of new look squads across the board. How wide open a championship do you reckon that will combine to produce?
It's always after a World Cup, it always seems to be the most open championship, and for those reasons, for new coaches, new players, new captains, and the unknown, no one can predict, because they haven't had anything to base it on. So it's exciting for you guys, it's exciting for us, and it really builds things towards next week.
How's the race for fitness?
It's good. It's obviously, when it happened, I suppose I was unlucky and lucky at the same time. It could have been worse, but unlucky how it happened. And met the specialists in London, and we based our plan off conservative management of it. And 8 weeks was his thing, which brings us to the Scotland game, and everything's gone smoothly. We're a little bit ahead of that.
So I'm hoping that things go well over next week and no setbacks or anything.
Just a word on the championship. Like, it's the one we all grew up watching, and your initial exposure to international rugby is the schoolboy tickets to go to the matches. That, irrespective of how other competitions have changed, this is still such an important part of what you guys do.
It's huge. Yeah, it's huge. And as players, I know sometimes there's an opinion that you need to sacrifice things for a World Cup. You know, we value this competition so highly and we want to do well in it, and it's massive for us as players. You know, you don't get too many shots at it, and you know, even from a union point of view, you know, it's important, and we're judging it as that. It's not a building towards anything. It's literally building for this championship, and that's all that matters to us at the moment.
That was Damien O'Mara chatting to Johnny Sexton. I found it interesting, Marie. I like the fact that when Andy Farrell asked him, he nearly offered, you know, if you think it's right to go for James Ryan or Peter O'Mahony, I'd back you, you know. And no, normally,
yeah, but that was after he'd asked him.
I know that, but at least he says that to anyone else. He says that to me. Dunners, I want you to be captain. I'm there. Nice one. Thanks a million. Brilliant. Done. Whereas he it kind of sums him up, and I know we kind of think of it, but he's a team player, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is. There was a lot of debate, I think, a bit unfairly, about whether he should be captain or whether he'd be a good captain, but I think he deserves the chance anyway.
Yeah, I agree. The one thing I've noticed, and I'll be honest, I'm not a leader, but in Worcester I was captain, and it actually made me appreciate my captains, that I could have taken more responsibility for them. And I think that's what he's saying. Like, there is additional duties like today that he has to do. He's already a 10, so that involves loads of extra kicking practice. So he's got a lot on his plate. And even on the Friday night at 6 o'clock, there's a thing called the captain's meeting, and you clear out all the coaches, you clear out everything else, and it's where the players take ownership. From there on in, they drive it all. And it's actually really important that the captain sets the tone at that meeting. So, like, they actually have to go away and put an awful lot of work into that meeting to actually, you know, sometimes they mightn't say a whole lot, and it's not what they say sometimes, it's the tone, and just even they could sit there in silence. I've been in there plenty of times with certain captains, and we've sat there for 5 minutes and then just got up and walked out, which is rare, but I think he does.
Come on.
Yeah. No one had anything to say. But I think he needs the likes of James Ryan and Peter O'Mahony. He needs fellas picking it up. And I remember it in Worcester, when guys would talk, I felt like hugging them. And then I was thinking of all the leaders I have, and here I am buttoning my lip, or not picking up standards, or not driving training. And that's what they need now. Johnny needs a bit of support, that he shouldn't have to self-police the standards. But what did you make of the nicknames?
That's what I wanted to ask you about. That, I know you're mad into your nicknames in rugby. In the
I
rugby
am Crowbar.
World. Right, we'll move on from that very quickly. But it just seemed a little bit too informal. And the reason I'm saying that is because I was out interviewing Jack Byrne today, and he referred to his manager at Shamrock Rovers and Republic of Ireland both times as the manager. Whereas I'm listening to Johnny there, and it was the same with Gary Ringrose last week when I interviewed him, and it's Faz.
It is Faz. And I think that's one of these ones that comes from being number two, because they're Faz. They were never called Joser. Hey, Joser.
Smitty.
What were they come up with? We didn't. Like, you didn't have, like, Tony McGann was Dumper, but it was Declan Kidney. You know what I mean? And we, like, Declan Kidney full title, not just Declan, you know? It was just, so I think, and even straight away you hear it with Catty, you know what I mean? My Cat. So I think it's one of those ones that you, there's massive respect in rugby, the ref is sir and stuff like that, but I think it's stuff that you have to watch, maybe, that there is that, I think there's a brotherly feel with Andy Farrell that'll have to be kept an eye out. Do you know who there isn't a brotherly feel with?
Ruby Walsh.
Eddie Jones. You're not wrong with Ruby. What? Ruby doesn't have a nickname.
He doesn't have one.
Yeah. He's enough on his plate with Ruby, though, doesn't he?
I think text into 51552 of what could Ruby's nickname be would be a good shout out.
I think we might have to screen that. There could be a few colourful ones.
I got a few tweets last night about him. All right, yeah. Eddie Jones, you say?
Eddie Jones was
this is he my Six Nations. This is probably the least number of injuries we've ever had. So we're in a very positive state. You know, it's common at this time of the year to have 15, 17 players in England unavailable. You know, and in reality, we've got Slady, Jack Noel, Billy, significant players for us, but players that we know we have the depth and talent to replace, and we'll just get on with it.
So is it a conscious decision then to go with new faces, to blood new players, to start a new chapter?
Well, I think every year, you know, traditionally you look to change the squad by about 20%. That's always been my coaching philosophy. And post the World Cup, you probably want to do a little bit more, and we're around that mark.
How much energy then do those new faces bring in to maybe reinvigorate things on a year-to-year basis?
Oh, they're so important. You know, young players bring enthusiasm, older players bring experience. And what do you want from your team? Experience, and you want enthusiasm. So they've got a big job for us, and they're such an exciting group of players.
Do you agonise much then on when is the right time to blood a player and bestow upon them the honour of becoming a fully capped international?
Don't agonise. I was lucky enough to be coached by one of the best rugby coaches ever, Bob Dwyer, and he always used to have this saying, players select themselves. And it's so true. You know, when a player is right, you know when to pick them.
Obviously there's an awful lot of change in terms of coaches, in terms of player dynamics. Would that all contribute to a far more open championship, do you envisage?
I think post the World Cup it always is, because sides or teams and nations take approaches where they either change the coach, or they've had a mature side at the World Cup and they need to regenerate, or they've had a young side at the World Cup and they just need that a bit. And because of that, there's less of a stability in terms of the teams. And as you said, that makes for a very open Six Nations.
Obviously, from an Irish perspective, our World Cup failed to reach the heights that we envisaged. You came so close to climbing Everest. Which is the harder to bounce back from?
I think both are difficult. And the reality, winning the World Cup's difficult. Because then, once you've won the World Cup, every team's coming after you for the next 4 years, which South Africa will experience. So everyone needs to regenerate. Everyone needs to refocus. It's how quickly you can do it.
I listened to a podcast with you on the flight on the way over, and at that stage, whenever it was recorded, you'd still not watch the World Cup final back. Have you watched it since?
I've watched bits and pieces.
Difficult?
Well, there's always a scar there. You know, the reality is there's always a scar from that game, and your ability to live with that scar is the most important thing.
But are those important, those scars?
Oh, 100%. You know, you don't see pretty heavyweight champions, do you?
So do you channel that then in the 10 days between now and the opening game?
For some players it'll be important, other players it won't, so we just need to find the right balance in how much we look at that and how much we take that forward.
I've no doubt you've probably been asked about Saracens as much as you have about England. Is it an unnecessary distraction for you?
It's opportunity. Great opportunity for us to get the teams tighter. For our Saracens players, it's a great opportunity for them to find the sanctuary. And the sanctuary is playing for England. Concentrate on what you love doing. What do you love doing? Playing rugby. The rest of it will sort itself out.
Has there been an unfair scrutiny on the players themselves?
Look, it's all part and parcel of how the media operates and how modern society operates, so no.
That was Damien O'Mara reminding Eddie Jones about their World Cup final. Fair play to Damien. Keep rubbing it in, Marie.
Yeah.
We've had a few texts to 51552 for nicknames for Ruby. You like a few of them, Marie. Nettle.
Very, very fitting.
Yeah. Little Red Riding Hood from Kev and Navin.
Not sure he'd like that one.
Ruby's nickname is Mr. Walsh. Cheers, Tom. Yeah, I think that's not a bad call.
He'd like that one. It's probably a safe call, I'd say.
Yeah. I think, who was it? It's gone completely out of my head. It was a legendary Australian player that had the nickname the Postman because he always delivered. And they're like, whoa, that's a hell of a nickname, isn't it?
Yeah, it's up there with Donners.
Do you know my nickname for a while was the Zebra? Because the lads felt it was a nothing animal. It was like a black and white donkey.
That's so mean. For you.
Yeah, 100%. But they were like, everyone, you know, you want to be a cool animal. Like, there you are. Just
who came up with that for you?
I think it was Frankie Sheehan and Anthony Horgan.
That is awful.
It's good. It's good fun.
I'm going to go with that now.
The Zebra.
Yeah.
interesting there, Eddie Jones, like 20% change in around tournaments. What if he hits kind of 15, 17%? Like, does he kind of... I know what happens there. That's like, if that's Irish camp, that's a chat with Andrew Trimble to make up the numbers and just boo them out.
I suppose he has to do something though, doesn't he? Like, yeah, just to freshen things up, because when you lose a World Cup final, I'd imagine it's really hard to get over it.
Yeah, and there's, like we were saying about even moving hotel and changing things up, bringing in new blood. But I find that quite Moneyball, like, that he actually knows the percentage of change he wants to make. I do agree with him, and he was saying, Bob Dwyer said, players select themselves. It's amazing, but the best team always goes out. And sometimes when you're not picked and you throw the toys out of the pram, in time you actually look back and kind of, or even within later in the week, you're like, yeah, best team always starts.
It's not as much as France, 19 uncapped players coming in.
There we go.
Where do you even start?
How do you get to know each other?
Yeah.
That's a night out.
That really is. So the Women's Six Nations is also starting very, very shortly, and a big one for Ireland because they had a disappointing Six Nations last year. So I think they just really need to improve. Although I was chatting to Senny Naipu about it, and she said this is actually a defining season for women's rugby in Ireland. So let's hear from her.
Preparations have been going well. Been training really hard in the last number of months, and certainly the last few weeks in preparation for the Six Nations campaign. We've one more training camp at the weekend before the squad is named for Scotland next week in Energia Park at 1 p.m.
So you went to Wales to take them on, and I saw your squad had a really good mix of youth and experience. How was the game?
The game was... it was good. It was we got out of it what we needed to. There's a few areas that we are aware of what we needed to work on, so that's always positive. And at the same time, we did some really positive things, which was encouraging. So from a squad point of view, it was also great to, have the full 26 get a run out and get some good time, game time as well. Also great to see a couple of the young ones, performing well as well. Dorothy Waugh was also in there, one of the newer sort of back rows, and Enya Breen in 13 position.
Adam said ahead of the game that playing Wales will give you the platform to fine-tune your game. Should we expect anything different from you this year that maybe we haven't seen before?
It's an exciting season. I genuinely believe we're on the verge of something special this season. We've been enjoying, learning and training and executing some of our new things that we've been working on with the new coaches that have come in from a defensive point of view and attacking and breakdown point of view. And yeah, Adam Griggs and all of the coaching staff have been fantastic. And it's something that, we're constantly enjoying learning and putting into practice at training. So it's probably one of the most competitive seasons in terms of position wise, across the whole squad. There's loads of competition up, amongst the different positions, which is a huge positive for the game overall amongst our squad.
It really is. And I know we often talk about the shallow pool of players that there is, because the game, whether we like it or not, for women is still in its infancy. Are you starting to see, though, maybe some of the girls coming through that have been exposed to the Irish women's team being successful and inspired by them?
Yeah, it's there's been some incredibly positive work that's been done from the grassroots up, and certainly an increase in participation from young girls and from school and clubs. The pathway has been really positive from a club and provincial up into the green jersey point of view, and certainly with the likes of, say Guinness with the event today, it's fantastic that, Guinness are rallying all of the pubs in Ireland. I think there's well over 7,000 pubs since 2017, I think it is, where Guinness is rallying all the pubs to show the women's game live at 1 p.m. next Sunday against Scotland. So that's a huge positive in terms of its visibility and showing women's games on TV, and being able to grow the participation as well, and also to be able to encourage people to actually get to Energy Park if they can.
So growing the participation, the numbers and grassroots and all that is huge, but how important is it to have success then at the top level as well to complement that?
It's important, obviously, you know, performance breeds, you know, success sort of helps breed that participation base. But look, us as a squad, we've a specific role to do, and we've a specific job as well to do as a job and as in individuals within the squad. And whoever gets the opportunity to play Scotland next week will get the first chance to really ensure that we represent Ireland in the best way that we can get the result.
Adam Griggs is well settled in now to his role. Is he doing anything different maybe this time around for this campaign? Has he changed his approach in any way?
Adam Griggs has been excellent, you know, for all of us, the squad, and with new coaches in, Steve, who is also our breakdown sort of attack coach as well, and Kieran Hallett, who has introduced some new defensive systems, our defence coach, which has been really exciting. Yes, he, I suppose from a coaching and leadership point of view, it's fantastic. Us as players are really feeding off the growth mindset that those guys have. We're getting really stuck in, and we've been working really hard with our strength and conditioning coach as well, and Ola Curran, which has been really positive. Certainly a lot of us girls are feeling in great shape compared to perhaps, you know. It's all very, very positive, and a lot of us are constantly learning from the coaches, which is obviously really important, and we're just really excited to execute certain plays and trainings and to ensure that we've got the detail right in training so that we can transfer that onto games.
Obviously what happens on the pitch can't be done without what the work that's put in off the pitch, and a huge amount is needed for that. Do you feel that you're supported enough now by your association?
Yeah, and it's fantastic that that we have had the opportunity to have the warm-up game as well the weekend. We've had opportunities to ensure that we've been training as, we've put in some high-quality training sessions as well at the new campus, which has been brilliant for us, training out in Abbottstown. The facilities there are, world-class, so that's always, also contributes to increasing the level of performance and recovery for us players. So certainly from that aspect, absolutely.
Is it enough though, Senny? Like, is it enough to have maybe like some extra games in a series, some extra camps? When you look at what other countries are doing and the investments that's going into the women's game in the likes of England, France, Australia, do we need more now so that you can push on?
We actually we have a very busy season ahead, and it's a season that we're all extremely excited about. With another focus, which is obviously in September with the World Cup qualifiers, with a busy season, the Six Nations starting obviously next week, and also some of the summer series as well. So there's plenty of opportunity for us to fine tune and get squads together, different combinations, and building towards Six Nations first, obviously, and then onto the next campaign before the actual qualifiers. So there's certainly enough opportunities there within the season. So we're excited about that.
So what have you learned from, the time has flown by? It's a year since last year's Six Nations. It didn't go the way that you wanted it to. What have you learned in that time?
I've learned lots of things, actually. there's what I'm really excited about is that there's some great clarity, and that we're adapting to what the game is becoming from a women's and a men's point of view, in terms of the style of play that teams are starting to play now, and how different defensive systems can combat certain things. So those sorts of things are some important aspects that we've learnt, and the fact that a lot of us the squad is on the same page is really exciting. You want to play games like that when you just have to go out there and execute.
What would be success for you in this Six Nations campaign?
We're taking it a game at a time. Yeah, taking it a game at a time. Whoever gets to represent Ireland against Scotland is the first challenge that we'll be up against, and obviously the next home game as well. The home games will be important to us, in terms of ensuring that we get the result.
There's lots of progress been made domestically, and we saw you lead out Leinster against Harlequins in the very first women's club game to be played at Twickenham. What was that experience like?
It was a phenomenal experience, actually. Yeah, been incredibly incredibly lucky and honoured to have been part of, you know, Leinster Rugby and be part of Leinster Rugby. And also, you know, even before then, I you know, you always remember where you come from. I did play a bit of, you know, time with Connacht Rugby, you know, years, many years ago. So, yep, certainly from, you know, growing the women's game overall, it's been exciting to be involved in those milestone events and to play against a team like the Harlequins over in Twickenham was certainly a highlight in a provincial sense in the year that we sort of doubled the championship this year.
And you've had some double headers as well here at home. What were they like?
Yeah, they were fantastic. In Energia Park, we had our Leinster women's team play after the Leinster men's during the season, which was exciting. It was great for you know, young girls to come out and get a chance to sort of see us and those who got to stay and support the women's game.
We saw some new clubs being set up as well this year, some AIL clubs. How important is that to spread rugby all around the country?
Hugely important, and it's fantastic for those two new clubs to be involved in the Energia AIL for the next season. I've been really fortunate to work with one of those clubs from a sort of guest coaching point of view, and look, you go out there and there's over 120 girls on the pitch. It's unbelievable. If anything, it's not only inspiring, but it's you know, there's a lot of talent in those clubs from age groups under 10s, 12s, under 14s, 16s, 18s up through the women's. There's certainly sustainable pathways in those particular clubs, you know, that will feed into you know, a pathway from a provincial and hopefully into green if that's what they, you know, young girls are looking to achieve. And if it's a provincial pinnacle event that they're looking for, then that's obviously you know, there for them as well. So it's an exciting time, and it's something that constantly needs to be worked at. Certainly a lot of, you know, behind the scenes work across all of the clubs that are doing some fantastic work, which is positive.
That was Seni Naiopu there speaking to me. She's helping to raise awareness for the Guinness brand because they're rallying pubs to show support for the Irish women's rugby team by screening Ireland's women's Six Nations games.
Yeah, you asked all the right questions, and to be fair, in terms of what she can answer, from where the women's game in Ireland has come from, where they nearly had to make their own way to Italy, and I remember chatting to Fiona Steed about the horrendous conditions they had to come through. She has seen massive changes in that, but it's still miles off, Marie. When you look at what's going on overseas, especially in France and England, and I know in Worcester they're putting massive money behind the women's team, but it's also coming from the sponsors. And it, like, I know we can't just, it might always sound like we're plugging or they want stuff like that, but it is important that Guinness get behind it. It's important that Vodafone sponsor the Interpros, you know, Energia Park, that there's a place for them to play. So it needs to be as led as well by sponsors saying, we want to see Munster, Leinster, Ulster and Connacht being competitive in the women's game as well, because you can have your Energia All-Ireland League with more teams, but where do your grassroots boys and girls go if there's... And I'll tell you where they go. They get picked off by France and England, and we're at the very start again where we were with Irish rugby at the start, with loads of guys playing for London Irish Arles. So I think there has been improvements, but there's massive ones to make.
Yeah, and it's a really important season coming up.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's. I got a kick out of they have to qualify for the Rugby World Cup. Our women's team have to. And we have to qualify for the 2003 World Cup in Moscow. For playing against Russia in Siberia. And I was a cover sub. That means, like, you're only injured if someone falls down 35 flights of stairs. So I was cover subbing. And I remember Rala, your buddy from Turnure, gave me one job in Siberia. Go get ice for the ice packs and for the drinks. And everywhere I went, Marie, and asked for ice, they burst out laughing. They just thought it was the funniest thing of all time that someone would be looking for ice in Siberia. That, like, I couldn't get it anywhere, and Rallo wouldn't believe me. Like, he was like, are you joking that you don't have ice for the lads?
So you didn't get any ice in Siberia?
I couldn't find ice anywhere. Well, like, you could get plenty outside, but you couldn't get it for a drink.
On that note, it's time to take a quick break.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette, new skin guard sensitive with unique skin guard technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Say bye to shave irritation. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Welcome back to Game On. Marie, we've been chatting over the last while, and especially with Ruby, but we never got to flesh out your weekend highlight an awful lot more. You were with the under-15s, the Republic of Ireland Irish under-15 soccer team.
Yeah, I spent the day with them. It was a super day. I got to go to the pre-match briefing, the team announcement. They went through tactics, got to watch the match, do post-match interviews. They were playing against Australia and they won 2-0. Kevin Zeffi and Alex Nolan both scored goals, and it was just a really, really good performance. They've now won 7 out of 7 international games this season. They beat England. They've just been playing really, really well. And I did a little feature on it with the help of my super producer, Ronan Lawler. And I started with a team meeting led by the under-15s head coach, Jason Donoghue.
Right, quick one. Timetable for the day. Quick meeting here, 20, 25 minutes. Pick the team. I'm going to go out then to set plays. Go in and show some clips that we played against England. Some good positive clips, good mindset going into the game. Go through the set players then, and then we go out with a football game. Have you got that?
Yeah.
The 11 will start, obviously. We get everyone on the pitch. We meet up next Tuesday, go travel to Spain, where everybody's going to start one of the two games, the first two games anyway. Is that okay? Yeah. Plenty of opportunity.
Oh boy. Oh boy. Oh boy. Yeah. Oh.
Clips just to show you, I want a positive mindset going into this game. Defensively, what we're doing well, I'll ask you as we go along. What's good? Moving. Many people are moving. Everybody. So, as a team, we're all going together, yeah? So, that communication is working. Have I made the point quite clear defensively?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah.
Good, okay. Let's have a look at a couple of really good attacking clips. Tip off. What are we going to do for the tip off? Overload. So, we get three of them all one side. Good quality pass going in here. This is as good as it gets, fellas. It's 14 passes, 20 seconds later, it's in the back of the net. And it's confidence. That's what we want from you. Confidence, intensity in the play. All those principles that you're seeing there, bring them all out. You got it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to leave her in that one.
Yes!
Captain, huge honour to captain your country. It's as big as it gets. Cottle Heffernan, give him a round of applause.
Carl Heffernan, and I play for Cork City.
So, Carl, you captained the Republic of Ireland under 15 team today against Australia. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was a dream come true. Like, I've always wanted to captain my country, and today for it to finally happen, it was a great experience. Like, I was very happy.
The performance of the team as well, Carl, it was so impressive. From the solid defence, the goalkeepers, right the way through, you really seem to have a fluidity about your play.
Yeah, we had to go through it at the start of the game, you know, that we were at a certain game plan that we were going to carry out, as we always do, that we're just going to, you know, go hard at every team and, you know, see what they throw at us. And today, they gave us a good challenge in the first half, but our class pulled through in the second half happily.
What does it entail playing for Ireland? Like, what do you have to do in terms of training and juggling school and everything?
Yeah, it's hard, you know, trying to juggle the two, but you have to, your school is important as well, but, you know, you know, I train probably like minimum 3-4 times a week. Just I try to get out just to keep my football ticking over, even if I'm not training with my club, just to, you know, try to push myself to the next level.
So what would you like to do then? What's the dream for you?
The dream is to, first of all, get to represent my country at senior level and get capped at that, and then hopefully get a Premier League start or start for my club in the future.
Your dad and mum, they must be so proud.
Oh yeah, they are, you know, I'm happy they didn't think it was a failure now, because, you know, there's a lot at stake, you know, because the two of them obviously being Olympians, you know, there was a lot of pressure on me to kind of pull through, but hopefully now I'm kind of taking over the role a small bit.
So your mum and dad are Rob and Marion Heffernan, who I met a little bit earlier on, and they're so proud of you. What does Rob in particular, who I think we're all so familiar with his voice, what does he say to you before you go out in these big days?
Oh, he kind of gives me advice, you know, because he's been through so much tough days in his life. So he just says, go out and express myself, you know, play every game the same, you know, high intensity, just stay concentrated and stuff like that. So No, he's a real help, you know, to have just going up in the car, you know, and before I go away, I'm always on the phone to him and just keeping in contact, and he's always giving me tips, you know, on high performance and stuff like that, like, and how to maximise performance.
First 15 minutes of every game, what do we do? Press them hard. Don't let any team ever settle and dominate possession against you. You got that?
Yeah.
No teams to sell. 15 minutes, you go out and you dominate from the start.
My name is Sam Curtis and I play for Shamrock Rovers.
You're not the only one in your family that plays football and plays for Ireland. Tell me about them.
My older brother Ben is playing with the 16s Ireland, and he's away in Turkey now playing a tournament for the 16s. And then I have my little brother Max, is now 12. He's playing a final and all now for his DDSL club, an All-Ireland final tomorrow. And then my little brother Cole is 8, and he's a fantastic little footballer, little winger. He's brilliant.
So what was it like growing up then in your house with four boys, all football mad?
Oh, it was unbelievable. We always pushed each other to be our best. We'd normally, my dad would take us to an indoor football place close to where we lived, and we'd go down and we'd do drills, we set out drills, we work on what we're not the best at, and then we work on what we're the best at, and we'll challenge each other to be the best we can be.
So you were the youngest player playing there today for the Republic of Ireland under 15 team. You've just turned 14, but you've already captained your country at 13 years of age. That's seriously impressive.
Yeah, it was unbelievable feeling going out captaining. Oh, it was unbelievable. And at that young of an age, it's just, what else can you ask for, really?
So yourself and Cahill are a very good partnership there. You seem to gel really well.
Yeah, great. He's unbelievable. He's the best centre-back I've ever played with. He's so, you know, you can trust him. He has my back, I has his back. We're together the whole way through the game.
So what does the future hold for you then?
Hopefully the future holds me. I like to go to England. I like to play football in England at a higher level than I am now. But the level that I'm on now is still unbelievable. But I'm hoping to go to England. I would like to play abroad. And hopefully I can stay in the Ireland squad up until senior age. It's unbelievable.
Does it give you a lot of confidence seeing so many young Irish players now doing so well over in England?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. For example, Troy Parra, I'm looking at him getting into the first team of Tottenham and all for a few games. He's unbelievable, he is. And I just, hopefully I can follow in his tracks to go and do the same what he's doing.
So you've just beaten Australia, a super performance, but it wasn't the team you expected in terms of age. Tell me about it.
Well, we came here and we planned that we were going to play an 0-4 age group where we're in 0-5 age group, but it just transpired they're 0-3. So it was a big physical battle for us, and our boys had to put up with it, which was great. Obviously we won, but the first half performance, we went in 0-0. I was more pleased that we actually matched them and still tried to play our football, their style of play. That was fantastic.
They really rose to the challenge, especially in that second half.
They dominated the second half, arguably controlled the game, managed the game really well by taking breathers, by keeping possession, slowing their high press down. Overall, I couldn't be more happier with them. It's great prep leading into the Spain tournament next week.
Just looking at all the players that have came through now and are starting to make their way in at a senior level in clubs in England, some in Premier League, Championship, how many of them have came through the system that you're looking at going, oh, I've seen that guy come through, I've seen that guy come through, and how much credit can the underage here in Ireland take for what's happening now at the top level?
Most have come through the Emerging Talent Programme, but also came through the grassroots clubs. Yes, we've a national league now, but everyone needs to realise, you know, they've all a small part to play in developing that player, that person, for want of a better word, to be honest. The likes of Troy Parra, you know, everyone's talking about Troy. He was here 2.5 years ago, maybe, and now he's played for a first team. But a lot of that would be down to his club in Belvedere, where he spent 9 years with. So there's a lot of different variables in terms of what makes the player be the player he is. But everyone should be just working towards making him the player he actually is, rather than taking credit for it. Just say, listen, I had a small part to play. He's doing really well. Let's hope he gets injured free, gets playing football, and then goes on and wins games.
So just in terms of the national team coaches, you and the other underage, how does it work then with football philosophy? Is there just an approach now that the whole FAI is adopting?
Well, to be fair, I know Rude Doctor gets a lot of stick at times, but one of the main things he's done, and that's worked for us, is we meet once a month, from Mick McCarthy right down to me at U15s level. And we go through all our game reports, our clips, our best players, our training, what we do. And we all work sort of in a layering approach of sort of improving the players as they get older, you know, the demands of the game, UEFA tournaments. And we just all make sure everyone's on the same hymn sheet in terms of what we expect from our players when they get to our first team.
So I am now joined by Rob Heffernan, father of Cahill. I'm no longer calling you Rob Heffernan Olympian. It's you have achieved something brilliant seeing your son play out there today, Rob.
Yeah, for me and Marion, we're very proud. I think every milestone when you represented Ireland first, you're so excited. And then that's done, that box is ticked and you move on. And today, even when he scored his goal against Poland, you're so thrilled. And now today, being captain, it's a huge, huge honour for him. But you're always looking for his reaction and how does he deal with it. And I thought he did well today and, you know, it's lovely. It's great.
I've spent the day with the Republic of Ireland under 15 team. The setup, Rob, they seem to be doing everything right.
They're doing everything right. And, you know, people are quick to go on about, you know, the bad stuff that has gone on. But ever since Cahill's been involved, since last year, the education, the balance in the education and how they carry themselves and then how they're complete animals on the pitch, but in a good way. They have a really good balance. There's a really nice respect. There's a good bond amongst them. And, you know, the training environment when they come in, it's a dream for me as a sportsman. Like, I've lived that life, but I had to pull in all of my kind of family and people to help me. And it's great to come up and just see things being done properly. And all he has to do is concentrate and playing ball. So he's living the dream in that sense, you know.
In a way, it's kind of almost like the pressure isn't on him as much because he's doing a different sport to you guys. Like, he's not doing athletics, he's doing football. So,
but I think, you know, for me, it doesn't matter if you're running or walking or playing football, the level is a bonus. So his natural attributes will get him so far anyway. With any of these players, they're all really talented and they'll be brilliant at every sport, but it's how they adapt to new challenges and how they grow, and that's the enjoyment in anything, you know. So it's, I think pressure's good. You need pressure as well to perform, like, you know, and pressure being in such a privileged position to be involved with an Irish team at any level and to have the opportunity to get better. I said, you know, that's only a positive. It's a positive pressure, you know.
In Ireland, we love making a fuss about people and we love hype and we love fast-tracking them to great things. But what would you like to see him achieve in his football career, Rob?
I just love when he comes away from this, he's playing a tournament in Spain in a few weeks and you want to see how he reacts to that. And even saying this morning, I goes, every time, I said, for as long as you ever do sport or if you're ever involved with Ireland, never, ever, ever take it for granted that every day that you go, you need to be 100% switched on. You need to love it and you need to feel privileged that you have the opportunity to represent your country. So once he's getting better and he's enjoying it and he just keeps on working hard, I think the key is, especially in soccer, you know, where people can get carried away with the lights, if you stay true to being a sportsman and you keep on wanting to work hard and get better, you know, it's up to him how far he wants to go, you know.
Lots of different voices there surrounding the Republic of Ireland under 15 team. Last one was Rob Heffernan, father of Cahill, who captained the team against Australia. We're going to continue our discussion about the development of football in Ireland after this quick break. David Snaid, soccer journalist, is with us in studio.
FM. Game on 2FM.
With Gillette Skin Guard Sensitive, the first razor of its kind designed to stop skin irritation. Revolutionary technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Welcome back to Game On. Marie, fantastic work by yourself and Ronan there. It was a great piece about the under-15s. Gave a real perspective on all the sides of it. Enjoyable?
Yeah, it was great. It was... Like, it's just nice to get to see that side of the game, because when you're a journalist or just a fan, like, you never actually get taken into what happens behind the scenes and how things are delivered and how tactics are explained. So to even go through it more, we have brought in David Snaid, soccer journalist. David, welcome to Game On.
Thanks very much. Good evening.
So they're a good team, aren't they?
The 15s?
Yeah.
They are, you know, and they're at that stage now. You just listening to that, and just part of me, you just have a bit of a smile on your face listening to them, because like, they're just so, I wouldn't say just innocent, but they've got everything ahead of them now with their careers, you know. They're with their different clubs in Ireland, and like, there's going to be a step they're going to have to take if they're going to become professional, but at the moment, for a lot of them, they still have those dreams, and it's just purely about the football and the enjoyment at this time for them, you know.
David, what I loved about it was the answers coming from the floor. So it can, you know, just what a brilliant way to kind of coach, instead of telling them what to do. Like, Marie, you got unbelievable access, but you could hear the answers coming from the deck. Is that normally the case at that age?
Well, like at this stage now, it would be because you speak to so many coaches around the League of Ireland, and obviously there's over the last few years now there's been the developments now with obviously the National League. So, like in Ireland traditionally, you would have the schoolboy clubs who would develop young players, and then like the culture is then they go to England at say 15, 16 and have to try and make a life for themselves and become professional so young. Whereas now there's the realization that that's not really a sustainable model to continue to produce really good young footballers, but also young lads. So coaches now, especially with the National Leagues, with the League of Ireland clubs, have become a lot more educated in how to deal with young people on a personal basis, which I'm sure yourself, in your own career when you were growing up, you would think would have been a major factor for yourself, you know?
Yeah.
We have a text in, well done on highlighting the great work being done in underage soccer. There's so much positives going on in the game. There really is. And David, you'll stay with us, William. We will chat about it after the news.
Yep. 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette Skin Guard Sensitive, the first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. So say bye-bye to shave irritation and razor bumps. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Now we are continuing our football chat, or soccer chat as some people call it, and David Sinead is joining us in studio. David, this time of year for young players who are trying to make their way and trying to get clubs in England, is a time where they might get snapped up?
Yeah, so like traditionally the culture in Irish football is lad gets to 15 years of age and they will have already been on the radar for a lot of English clubs if the player itself is at that level. So like I've been working on a piece for this weekend for the 42, and it's just very interesting to speak to different people around the game how around this time, January, February, clubs now are beginning to make sure that they're getting their lads in for the summer to begin their, basically to begin their careers. But like you speak to people and I don't think the kids realise sometimes, you know, they see maybe a club coming in from the Premier League or even the Championship, and sometimes parents see kind of the dollar signs flashing, and that's not what it's about, you know, because like there could be, if you're a really talented kid, you might get a good deal once you're on the pro. But if you're 16, you can only go on YTS schemes, which is youth team. Now, the most you can make when you're on that scheme is £180 a week, you know, because you have to do your education as part of that. And these big clubs in England, these kind of like conglomerates almost at this stage, they're getting funded by the British government to do that for these kids. So the kids have to get the right deal for themselves if they're even gone, because you look at it and they could be on 2 years of a YTS, maybe 1 year of a professional contract, which might bump things up, but there's just no guarantees, you know. Like we were chatting to Jack Bourne today, obviously, who has come back into the League of Ireland after being at various different clubs because he had to leave Manchester City. And now he went to Manchester City because they were a club who had this brilliant academy and were pumping loads of money into it, and like he's competing against the best players in the world, you know. He was telling me like he lived in digs with Angelino, who is like at the stage now where he's around the first team and stuff. So like this is what the challenge are for young lads. And then there's this balance as well. You see today as well, like this afternoon, like Jason Knight, who gets a new contract at Derby County, 18 years of age, and he's a regular in midfield or sometimes on the left for Derby County in the Championship. Like he left Cabinteely to go to Derby County because they're the only club for him. And it's just a very, I'd say, perilous time, because players have to pick the right club if they're going to the UK. And getting that pathway into a first team, because like you speak to parents, you speak to obviously the kids, you speak to the clubs, and it's, they all have to get to that first team, but there's such a small percentage who actually get there. And that's why it was so interesting just listening to the piece you did there with those kids. And like one of the young lads there was mentioning, talking about his dream is to get to the Premier League, and he's already mentioning Troy Parrott. And like Troy is 17 years of age, full Ireland international, and yet there's already these talks about getting into the Spurs squad. You know, he's not in the squad for the game tonight. He's had his debut, and it's just that continuous, obviously, like the wheel spinning constantly of lads going over, and you just want to see what's actually going to happen with them, you know.
But David, we also heard Cathal Heffernan saying that he just wants to play a level up. Yeah. So is that a kind of coaching mindset that, you know, they have, like when you hear his dad, who would know high performance and know what good is, we hear so much bad. but he couldn't speak highly enough about what goes on at the grassroots level. Mm. Is that the way to develop our next pool of talent? Slowly work them up and try to keep them at home?
Well, that's it. And the key word there is slowly, because like at this moment, obviously, Cottle's in with Cork City, and Colin Healy there, who just has a tremendous amount of experience in Ireland and obviously abroad, he's running things for Cork City with their academy. But at this moment, there's not a proper industry around keeping young kids in Ireland, and not just the ones who maybe, because it always could be certain kids who are just destined for greatness, if you put it that way. But it's making sure what's here for kids in terms of getting to that age of 15, 16. Can they continue their education? That's what needs to be really kind of the infrastructure needs to kind of be developed. So obviously there's League of Ireland clubs now with the national leagues who are trying to get their house in order. But there's something bigger needs to be done in terms of government, even kind of assistance, whereby young lads can stay here, continue their football education, and as you say, because not everyone's going to get to the Premier League or get to England, they're going to be going to hopefully into the League of Ireland, but they need those structures even at that age, from say 16, 17, because it's such a big leap to get from any academy system into a first team environment where basically the whole thought process has changed. It's like, it's no longer just about your own development as a person and as a player, it's about results. And it is slow and it is happening, but it will take time, and you just hope that clubs can continue to get the support from kind of external circumstances. Like you look at Shamrock Rovers at the moment, like Dermot Desmond is kind of majorly now a part of that club, one of the part owners, and like he's big time now going to be obviously hopefully investing in that academy. But it can't just be people coming through, it needs to be kind of obviously as well that government assistance too, you know.
Like, there's no doubt that football development, David, has been hampered by everything that's been going on off the field. Do you think that we will get to a stage where we have a football industry in Ireland that is viable, that is working well for the future of Irish football?
When you look at the people who are working in the game, you would hope and you would think that would be the case. Like, there has been, obviously, what's happened with the FAI has been is well publicised, but there has still been good work in terms of with like the emerging talent programmes, in terms of identifying these kids. But it is like you go to football in the UK and even in Scotland and even the lower leagues, in terms of leaving some with League One or Championship, it's an industry and a business, and there can be an element to it where it's cutthroat. But If you're gonna have that here, there just has to be the proper infrastructure. There has to be clubs who have proper training grounds for these kids to go to, who have the qualified coaches. And it is, like Antonic has mentioned earlier, or Dunners, as you were saying. it is slow, and like there's no problem with that, because if you rush into things and you just kind of throw money at it or throw certain situations at it, maybe that's not going to actually be the right way, and it's not going to actually develop it. And if it's the proper infrastructure is in place and the proper pathways are in place, then slowly but surely you would hope that for those lads who maybe can develop in Ireland and continue their careers in Ireland, that the proper infrastructure and kind of stability is there for them.
David, is this the light at the end of the tunnel? But all the bad we hear going on in the FAI, when you hear the likes that Mick McCarthy meets up with the under-15s management, that the grassroots level are working, we heard it in Marie's interviews there with Belvedere and working across it, you mentioned the football development, the talent pools, like it is taking shape, it needs to be supported and nurtured, doesn't it?
Oh, of course. And like the fact that Mick McCarthy is meeting with these underage coaches can only be a good thing. And what provides a lot of hope for that afterwards will be when Stephen Kenny comes involved. Like, that's someone who is like steeped in Irish football, someone who has no inferiority complex about what he knows what Irish players are capable of. And you look at his, even just taking that under 15 team, who can go and beat England comfortably. Like this is where it's a bit of an issue in terms of like the culture in Ireland is always these young lads who have all the talent and they stay here and they're based here up until a certain point, and then we lose them, and then they go to England, some come back and they're just demoralised and fall out again. So what you're saying there about that, De Bruyne and the hope, that's always been there. There's always been these talented kids, but the problem is that the structures haven't been in place in Ireland to either A, keep some of those who maybe aren't quite ready to go to England and actually give them a reason to stay here, but also be when those, because it's just the nature of it, it's just hopefully it might change over a long period of time, but the culture is best lads will always want to go abroad. But even if those lads do come back, that there's something there for them, that the club that they've been with from the age of 12, maybe 13, 14 and then left, that they can offer them something. That's going to be the big thing here in the League of Ireland with the responsibility. And you see the people who are working on the ground, especially in the League of Ireland, that's what they're aiming towards, and you just have to kind of stick with it and just hope that it comes to fruition.
It does help when the likes of Jack Byrne is standing up almost to the minister when he makes comments that the league is for developing young players, but it's also for the likes of Jack Byrne, that someone who's gone over and came back again.
Well, that's it. And like, if you look in the League of Ireland, there's just so many of those stories. Like, I know myself, from when like interviewing players and doing like articles with them, and like there's always that element of the story of, you know, kind of heartbreak in the UK and coming back, and all of them always say, well, if it wasn't for someone taking that chance on me. Like, prime example would be Patrick McElhenney, who's at Dundalk. When he came back, he was just playing football. He was at Sunderland. He just came back and was playing five-a-side Astro matches up in Derry in cages. Stephen Kenny just happened to pop up one evening, saw him and brought me into Derry City. And if it wasn't for that, like, who knows if someone like Patrick McElhenney, who's been one of the best players in the League of Ireland for the last few years, would have been lost. And that's what the league has to be. It has to be obviously a place where young kids can develop, but it has to be a competitive league at the same time. Like, there is that balance there too, you know.
That interview with Jack Byrne will be played tomorrow, and he talks about his conversation with Minister Brendan Griffin.
Yeah, Marie, I'm interested in everyone in Cork, of course, are chatting about Cathal Heffernan, and you saw the game. How good is he? Like, having a talent pool of two Olympic parents, I'd say he's quite special.
He's very special. He's a big guy, which surprised me, because Rob isn't a big guy.
No.
But he's big, but he's also, like, I mean, you're looking at him and he's 14 years of age, but he's so mature and he was so composed on the ball and, like, just never panicked, like, able to control the ball at his feet, like, just calmly pass it out from the back. When he was contesting headers, just, like, cleared them every time. Just really, really super.
Like, which bodes well. The only issue with that, and I don't want to be showing dampeners on that, is that's basically every centre back or every midfielder now that's produced. True. Every player is really like that. And if just to get you excited about someone from Cork, like Sean McLaughlin, who came through at Cork City, actually got released by Cork City at the under 19s, then got a chance back under John Caulfield to go back into the first team. He's gone over to Hull City. He then went on loan to St Mirren for 6 months, playing centre back, played every game for St Mirren in the SPL, and now was brought back by Hull in the Championship, who are only 6 points off the playoffs. They play Chelsea on Saturday. He could be in with a shout, and this is a centre half who's had the knocks. He's 23 years old, but could actually properly make a real career for himself, and that's another indication of lads who have to go a long way around.
David, that would be brilliant, but half Cork is wondering, could he hurl?
He actually played rugby, but then he said his true love was football.
So he's dead right.
He's got a place in my heart, anyway.
So, like, we're always talking about how we don't have enough good players in Ireland. But when you look at the last week and our Republic of Ireland players who have played in the Premier League, there's been quite a lot of them. Randolph, who's going to play again tonight. Clark, Coleman, Egan, Stevens, McCarthy, Obafemi, Long, Harahan, Connolly, Hendrick, Doherty, all in the last week.
It's not bad.
And we've got still a whole three fixtures tonight, another one tomorrow.
No, that's it. And like, even if you look at the games that are even happening tonight, obviously Leicester, West Ham, Darren Randolph, like, that's someone who's a bit older, but like, probably surprised a few people by going back into West Ham after being playing for Middlesbrough in the Championship. But once Lucas Fabianski comes back, will Randolph actually still be first choice? Then that throws the element of doubt into what happens in March with the playoff game against Slovakia as well. But it's just like, if you look at the big, everyone's talking about Troy Parrott in terms of with Spurs. You look at Spurs haven't scored a goal in open play since St Stephen's Day, not scoring the last three Premier League games at all. And Jose Mourinho is obviously coming out and saying he's just not ready. And like you said yourself in the piece there, we want someone to get excited about. But this is someone who I think we can be excited about. And like Jack Byrne was even talking about today, saying, well, he's still only 17, let things flow. But I think sometimes with a player, you get to an age, you get to a point, regardless of their age, that they need to keep going. They need to try and have that next challenge and the next step. And from speaking to people about Troy Parrott, he is one of those people. Like, he's not playing 23s football, even for Spurs. He's not involved in the Spurs squad tonight for our game against Norwich. And, like, lads, it doesn't matter. Like, and even Donoghue will know this. Even, like, young lads, like, not that they're prodigies, but certain lads just need to keep on getting that next test to see how they go. And I know we get excited and sometimes they need to be reined in, but I think in Troy Parrott's case, he is one of those type of players who just needs that next challenge almost now to see how he goes.
David, especially with that stat you had, they haven't scored in open play since Stephen's days, was it?
Yeah, in the Premier League, yeah. Spurs, like, you know, and I think it's in the last three games at all that they actually haven't scored, and it was since Harry Kane. Obviously, Harry Kane's going to be out now for the next while, and obviously Jose Mourinho doesn't want to bring him in, which is, like, I suppose his right. He was not going to question Jose Mourinho, but, like, even if it's a loan move for Troy, because that's a big one, you know, because he was like, we can forget, like, McCarthy wouldn't have brought him in for that game against New Zealand, even though it was a friendly, if he didn't see something in him. And all the reports are of a lad who has his head screwed on and someone who takes things in his stride. So you would just hope that if he does get a chance again, that he'll hopefully be able to take it.
David, you'll be interested in the Manchester United team news. They have made two changes from their defeat to Liverpool. Phil Jones replaces Victor Lindelof, who's ill, and Mata comes on for Luke Shaw. And then in the Burnley team, Jeff Hendrick is starting and Brady is on the bench.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Even like, when you were saying there that United were making two changes, I wasn't sure if one of them was the manager. But but that's an interesting one. Like, even with United, like, they're, like, I think Solskjaer now is at the point where he's on a bit of a hiding to nothing, isn't he? Especially after what happened at the weekend. Like, there was a lot of talk that, like, there's so many moral victories now with that Manchester United seem to be having, and they kind of lost the fact that they actually have to win games, not just moral victories, you know.
And Burnley beat Leicester as well.
I know. Well, that's even with Burnley. Like, you look at it, like, Burnley were struggling for a while, and then they get that victory over Leicester. They go there to Old Trafford and maybe cause an upset, sneak a 1-0 win, they go level with Arsenal. You know, it's just crazy how the Premier League is at the moment. You can throw a blanket over so many teams.
Well, we will have updates from all of those games throughout our show tonight. David, thank you so much for joining us. It's time for a quick break. 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Okay, every Wednesday we try to fill the void of losing Ruby Walsh by inviting a legend of Irish sport in to join us. We know that's an overused phrase when it comes to sport, but not in the case of Ursula Jacobs. Having won 10 Leinster titles with Wexford, 4 All-Irelands and 4 All-Stars, we're delighted to have her in studio. Ursula, how are you?
Good, thanks. Great. Great to be here on a Wednesday.
Sure, what else would you be doing?
Exactly.
Hanging out with us here.
Yeah.
Ursula, I have to say, of all the people that we've come into studio, I was really excited about you because your family are the ultimate GAA family. It must just be hurling, hurling, hurling.
Yeah, from a very young age. I don't think we knew anything else but hurling and camogie. But my parents, Mick and Breda, would have represented Wexford at intercounty level. So I think, you know, we were nearly born with a hurl in our hand. And then growing up, my two brothers, my sister, myself, were always out on the front lawn, down in the pitch every single day. And, you know, it was back then where we really got the love for it. We weren't forced into it or, you know, made play hurling or camogie, but it was what we did. It's what anyone does in Owlert, where I'm from. And nearly if you don't play the GAA down there, you're left out.
And Ursula, we chat about that, and especially with clubs. For you to actually win two as well, two All-Irelands, tell us about that.
Four, isn't it?
Well, two with the club.
Oh, two with the club and four with the county.
Four with the county. So, look, I've 100% record in Crow Park. I've played 6 All-Irelands in Crow Park, 4 with Wexford, 2 with my club, and I've won every time. So it's not a bad record to hold when you're playing in the best pitch in Ireland.
So tell me about your mum, because from what I heard, she is always down showing everyone how to play hurling and camogie. She was a school teacher, like anyone that came through the club, she was the one who put the hurl in their hand.
That's it. She was the primary school teacher in Owlert, and herself and Breda Flood, who would have been the principal at the time, really developed all our skills and, you know, roped in my dad in to help him out in the school when we were 6, 7, 8 years of age. So from that time right up to senior players at the moment, you know, they've coached every young person nearly in the village. And Mam was really a driving force. And it was great to see, even back then, 20, 25 years, that you know, women were leading the way in the GAA club, and Mam is still there on the committee helping out and making sandwiches and doing fundraiser. And it's great that you still see her, you know, contributing, and she still loves it to this day.
Ursula, obviously she's contributing, but was she tough on your game? Would she like pick up, you know, coaching points?
Yeah, like, look, she was as tough on me as anyone else, but, you know, never overly critical, always very encouraging. And, you know, she didn't care when we were in school whether you were the best player or maybe not that into sport. She was just happy that everyone was out on the grass at lunchtimes, break times, whether you were with a hurl, a ball, whatever, as long as you were active. But yeah, it was handy at times having a teacher as your parent in the school if you wanted to run up to the shop for something nice.
You got used to winning very early in life though, Feilaz.
Yeah, some of the best memories I have at underage level was winning the Feilaz with my club, and luckily we won our Feilaz in Wexford at the time. And when I think back, you know, we played Milford in the final, and some of the greatest players, you know, Anna Geary, Elaine, and the Watsons and that down there. So it was great. Brilliant memories and a real honour to win an All-Ireland title at such a young age as well, because it's such a prestige competition and still is to this day.
Do you know what's great as well, or what I enjoy, is that I know from listening to you that you're all treated the same.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's not always the case, Donegal.
No, not in our house. I'm my mum's favourite.
Well, people would have said I was the favourite because I was the youngest, but I don't agree. But no, Mam and Dad were always as equally as supportive to Helena and I as much as Michael and Rory. And it was great. You know, we all just loaded up into the car and off we went to whether it was a Camogie match, a hurling match. And it was difficult at times to try and make all the matches and trainings because we were all going in different directions. But look, we'd have it no different either.
So when did you first make your intercounty debut?
I was 14 years of age.
I knew it. Wow. I knew it.
So it's a fairly memorable occasion. At the time, I was playing under 14 and I had broken my wrist a couple of months previous. And I ended up playing in the goal for the under 14s. And we won the Leinster final that year. And the senior manager at the time, Dan Quigley, who was a great Wexford hurler, was impressed with how I did at under 14 level. And I suppose maybe back then Wexford Camogie was struggling with numbers and whatever. So I got the invite in. And as a, you know, fairly shy under 14 player, being invited into a senior setup was a huge deal. And, you know, I went in and I suppose there was no nerves, no expectations, nothing, because, you know, I didn't know anything about what a senior setup was going to be like. So my debut was against Tipperary, who were the stronghold of Camogie at the time. And we played in front of the Kerry Dublin game in Thurles that year when Maurice Fitzgerald got that famous point. So I'll remember that game so well. But I remember standing in the goal that day, and the first half, there was only a couple of hundred people there. But by the time second half started, there was thousands of people. And I think for the whole second half of the game, I was looking up into the stand at the crowd and taking in the whole experience. And I remember even sharing the dressing rooms at the time. We were sharing it with the Dublin footballers, which clearly wouldn't happen nowadays. And I remember Jason Sherlock coming out of the bathroom, and my eyes just lit up that I was, you know, even in the same vicinity as someone like Jason Sherlock. So it was a great day. We didn't we didn't win the game, but it was a great experience to be involved in.
But just there, as a 14-year-old, because we hear it so much that we have to protect young people and not throw them in. Like, how old were some of your teammates in that team?
Oh, sure. Look, at the time, they were probably in their 20s, 30s. You know, it wasn't overly common back then. With Wexford, there was myself and Mary Lacey. And now there obviously is a rule nowadays that you have to be 16 minimum age, because probably 14 was a little bit premature. But look, as I said, I didn't know any difference and I didn't get nervous. I absolutely enjoyed it and played Wexford Camogie for 16 years.
I actually remember around then, maybe a little bit before you, but Veronica Curtin won All-Ireland with Galway, and I think she was 15 at the time.
Yeah, so it was pretty common. You know, you had Claire Grogan as well for years playing with Tipperary, and she was in or around my age as well. So look, we didn't know any different. And it was, you know, the girls that were in their 20s and 30s, yeah, they did seem that bit older. But from developmental purposes, I suppose, I felt like I was the same as them, really.
Yeah, and I think probably at club level as well. I think when you're from a small area, you end up in, like, who can play? Anyone can play. Like, just get out and play. And away you go. You'd hear so much of, like, mothers and daughters playing and aunts and nieces and that. But, like, you're right, because they're real now. But even so, it's not so much anymore because the training and everything is a lot different nowadays.
Oh, completely. And the training back then, you know, was basic enough. You know, you did a bit of ball work, a little bit of running, and off you went then. You know, there was no strength and conditioning or diets or nutritionists, but it was a thoroughly enjoyable time. But thankfully my goalkeeping days didn't last too long because I didn't overly enjoy that.
I know everyone in Cork wishes you stayed in goal. What was your score in that 2012 final against Cork? Was it 2-7?
2-7, yeah.
Breaking our hearts.
And Ursula, like, could you, from when you were small, like, were you, like, clearly you have the skills. Were you just always able to hurl? Was that it, like?
God,
were you one of those people that was always really good?
She had been that hoax.
We had no other choice. I remember looking back at, we have an under 10 video at home, and looking back at it now, and I was playing in the forwards even back then. And I suppose I don't think I've changed my style or anything, even from the age of 6 or 7, and I'm now 30 plus years age, you know. So I think I probably always had a natural amount of skill and then really worked hard on it and just loved it. And, you know, when you love something so much, you'll do anything to improve and get better. And that's the attitude I've always had, that I don't think you can always be your best. You can always look for improvements every year.
Yeah, it's amazing. We were, Marie was out and chatting to the under-15s, and she caught up with Rob Heffernan, and I found it really interesting what he said about his young boy playing. And I think it's a lesson for every parent to love it and enjoy it. And you're saying it was the exact same for you. You loved it.
Yeah, and right up until when I retired with Wexford, I enjoyed every moment with Wexford. 16 brilliant years. We won lots, we lost lots, but I just enjoyed the whole camaraderie, the friends I made, the memories I made, even the losses. You know, it made you stronger. You learned how to be more resilient in life and everything. So it's had a really positive impact on my own personal life, my work life now as well. And I'm still continuing to play with the club, so I'm still getting to enjoy it and playing with such a great club as Owlert. It's always a brilliant feeling.
Tell us about that first All-Ireland that you won.
Back in 2007, it's hard to believe it's going on 13 years. And, you know, I was still, 18, 19 years of age. And I just remember Stella Sinnott coming in that year and the professionalism that had come in with that year, and Stella's management team was second to none. You know, it was the first time where nutrition was taken on board. Even we were doing strength and conditioning, and it was just a really enjoyable year. And the championship was so competitive back then because we had 7 group games before we even reached the semi-final. So you really had to go about it the hard way. But I just remember, obviously, it was my first time playing in Croke Park, and we were coming up against Cork, who were going for the 3 in a row. So that was a massive deal. And they were probably going in as strong favourites. But we were quietly confident going in. But I just, the atmosphere and the buzz that was there that day, I'll never forget the screams of the kids that were there and walking around Croke Park. It's what you want to do when you're a young kid. And it was a brilliant experience. And it's funny, I don't remember a huge amount about the match, but I remember the simple things like, you know, getting to hug my sister after the game, meeting my parents after the match, the homecoming, you know, the thousands of people that came supporting us. And it was one thing that was always associated with Wexford Camogie was the support we had, and the thousands of people that were there that day was just something I'll always remember.
So Stella Sinnott, like, back then, was there a lot of women managing teams?
No, really, there wasn't, you know. And Stella really was a you know, trendsetter.
Back. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And she did a brilliant job, and she got good people in around her, but her level of professionalism was just, you know, unbelievable. And she had us all in check, and she knew when to get the best out of us. And, you know, raised our confidence when needed, and even the simple things of making sure we had food every night after training. And they're the simple things that even teams nowadays are looking for.
I was about to say it's not happening all the time now,
you know. So even back then, which was 13 years ago, you know, in fairness to her, she just brought the standard of Wexford Camogie up to a different level, and you know, we owe her a huge amount for that. And she really led the way for women managing Camogie teams.
Just at that point, when you win your first one and you're that young, do you think you're just going to do that every year now?
Yeah, I think that seeped into 2008 slightly. I think we nearly thought we were invincible, and we were still celebrating. And I remember our team holiday, we ended up going to Florida, and we headed off in the April of 2008. We were nearly still celebrating, you know, a full year on. So we didn't have we had a disappointing 2008, 2009, and we kind of only got things back on track when it came to 2010. But you did nearly think you were never going to lose a game again. And it took us, you know, 3 years to get back to Croke Park. And look, we had obviously a great run then, but definitely I think we nearly got caught up in the hype of the celebrations and the excitement of winning too.
I'm going to play you a clip now and you can tell me what you were feeling at this moment.
All inside towards Ursula Jacob. Can she do it again?
So what did you do there, Ursula?
I jumped. look, I think it's probably the most memorable score I'll ever get, really. And getting a goal like that on All-Ireland final day will always be special. And it was a brilliant final in general. The standard of Camogie that day from both teams was exceptional. And look, I don't think I've ever struck a ball off the ground since then, but at the time it was just massive. And, you know, in fairness, a lot of people would still mention it to me and, you know, give me massive credit for it. But look, at the end of the day, I was happy enough as long as we won the game. But it was a great strike, and I owe a lot to the surface of Croke Park for it too, you know. So
you all say that. I love the guy lines. Thank the groundsman. Thank everyone else. Like, looking at that goal, it's an incredible bit of skill. Ursula, you know, when you leave it all, like, for a second there, you're actually a spectator as well. You know, that moment where you're watching it.
Yeah.
What's going through your head?
Well, I knew at the time, I remember clearly the ball coming in, and I remember saying to myself, I have a split second here, and I didn't think I was going to have a chance to pick the ball. So I think I just hit the ball and hope for the best, and thankfully I struck it probably the best I ever did. And it was a crucial goal at a really important time, because Cork had just scored a goal down the other end. And look, as any Cork team are, they'll never give in, and you really have to drive it home when you do get in front. So it was great, and to win the three in a row that day was extra special, and it's something that I'll cherish forever with Wexford.
Yeah, it just, when you look at that, three in a row, like we chat about, that just shows consistency of performance. It shows unbelievable dynamic of a group as well.
Yeah, and we were so blessed that we had such a core group of you know, strong, committed women who were willing to do anything to play with Wexford and win with Wexford. And JJ Doyle was at the helm for those 3 years as well. And again, he pushed us, you know, to places that we probably didn't think we could go to. And there was just such a united group there, and a core group of girls, as I said, that were willing to do anything and would fight for each other on the pitch and off it as well. So it was a great memory. We all know how hard it is to even win one All-Ireland, so to win three will always be special.
Ursula, does it make it hard now when you think of what you had and then compare it to last year when Wexford were struggling to field a team at senior level?
Look, without a doubt, it was really, really disappointing to witness last year. And it was obviously the thing that anyone, whenever you met anyone in the streets or wherever, they would ask you, what's going on with Wexford Camogie? And it was very disappointing. I always knew there might be a little bit of a dip because a lot of girls were retiring or, you know, taking a time out from Camogie. But look, credit the county board over the winter, went in search of a new management team for this year. And Kevin Tatton is the new Wexford manager, and he's a Cork native. So hopefully that'll be a good thing. And I think it's maybe no harm having an outside manager coming into it. You know, there's no, you know, there's no history there. You know, he's coming in fresh, new, he's got ideas. He's trying to get the standard back up, and hopefully in the next couple of months they can develop it, because they're in Division 2 of the league this year, and I think that will actually help gain their confidence, momentum in winning in a couple of games, and hopefully pick things up again, you know, like where it used to be a few years ago.
Is it different now for young girls and boys, men and women? Like, is it a case that maybe playing for your county doesn't hold the same allure as it maybe it did for you when you started as a 14-year-old?
Well, I suppose when I was 14, maybe there wasn't other options, whereas now there seems to be so many other distractions. Mm-hmm. And maybe the commitment levels, some people, whether it's male or female, struggle with that. And playing inter-county, camogie, hurling, whatever sport you may play, like, it's huge commitment. And I think maybe you see it with some of the hurlers, like Padraig Mahoney, who was only, what, 29, 30, retiring. It's the huge commitment levels, I think, maybe, that people are struggling to find the balance, and maybe the enjoyment is not there. So I think maybe that might be why some girls in particular may not continue to play for as long as maybe some of us.
So camogie does get its fair share of criticism, we know that. But in fairness to the Camogie Association, they are now doing their bit to change what the players think that need to be changed, and they're going to trial some new rules in the league. There's six rules, I'm not going to go through them all, but what do you think is going to be the best one?
Definitely the physical, the minimal physical contact. Look, the game has progressed and moved on from even back when I started, and it has become more physical, and no one's promoting dirty play, but there is that element of, you know, there is going to be, it's not a non-contact sport. Playing camogie is tough, it's physical, you know, you are going to get tackles, you are going to sometimes maybe shoulder each other. But I think as long as the intent is not, you know, there's no intent to be dirty on someone, I think it's okay. I think, and even though I'm a forward and I would have scored plenty of hand pass goals, I actually think getting rid of the hand pass goal and dropping the hurl is actually a positive move for camogie, because to me there's not that much skill in hand passing a ball into the net. I think it looks so much better, and that a girl can strike it into the net. I just, for me, that's a personal thing. I think the more that we align our rules with hurling, the better. And the penalty rule is quite interesting, that we are moving it to only one in the goal as well. So it'll be interesting to see how the likes of Aoife Murray, Emma Kavanagh, whoever in the goals will deal with that. You know, it's going to be a bit of a difference for them. So I think it's really progressive, and it's important that to recognise the Camogie Association listen to the players and what they think.
I know the players didn't ask for the skirts to be gone, but what do you think?
I'm kind of 50-50 on it. Sometimes, I suppose a few years ago, I probably would have said the shorts, but I maybe think the skirts actually look well on us women. It doesn't overly bother me. I know we all train in our shorts, so maybe it's as well we all play in our shorts as well. I don't think there's really any fuss over that, but the other rules I think are that bit more important. And the other rule that's going to be interesting, where the free is being struck out with a hand. Now, I know it's going to be an indirect free, but it'll be interesting to see how teams will, you know, employ that, and will they use it.
One thing that always comes up throughout the year is the fact that camogie and ladies football are still not under the umbrella of the GAA. Yeah. And you'll know, and anyone who's involved in ladies football and camogie, know how difficult it is to get facilities, to try and plan fixtures, to try and plan matches, because they can't get pitches, and they can't get access to things that are essential if you want to grow your game. Do you think we will ever get to a stage where we're under the one umbrella, where all the sports are under the same umbrella?
Well, I'd hope we will, because I think that's the only way that camogie and ladies football will fully move forward. You know, it's great. Next week, Cork and Waterford in the Camogie League are playing in front of Cork and Tipperary. That's where you need to align the games, rather than having Cork and Waterford in the camogie playing in some random pitch in Cork. It's great to see that they're going to get to play in front of the Cork and Tip hurling game, and that's how camogie and ladies football will move forward and progress, because the more visibility that they get and the ladies' games get, the more it'll be promoted. We've seen in Croke Park this year, the camogie finals, the attendance was improved. But you have to build on it from this time of the year. You need to keep working together and not fighting against each other and being stubborn about it. You need to be trying to see, how can you accommodate the dual players if there is still going to be dual players there? How can you get camogie matches, you know, aligned beside big hurling games? That's how you're going to promote the game more.
So we don't really have a top two anymore in Camogie. We have a top three and a top four, really, if you count Kilkenny, Cork, Galway and Tipperary. Is there anyone else that could join that party?
I'm really excited to see how Waterford will do this year. I think Fergal O'Brien coming in, you know, Donal O'Rourke did massive work with Waterford, but I think Fergal O'Brien and even the presence of Dan Shanahan on the line, I think it's going to be brilliant. And their experience, you know, even what they would have learned and from being involved with Derek McGrath and Waterford, I think Waterford are the really exciting team to look forward to this year. They fear no one. They were, you know, really close to knocking out Galway in the championship, and you know they were recognised for their efforts this year with Beth Carton and Lorraine Bray getting all stars. So I think they're the up and coming team. I think they're going to be there thereabouts, and I think they'll give it a great shot this year.
So speaking of breakout stars, you were a breakout star on in the punditry. Yeah. How did you enjoy it?
Really enjoyable. It's tough work. I have a greater appreciation for people on the other side of things now. You know, I've someone.
It's so hard, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, I've learned loads in the last year and I've met some great people, and still a bit surreal going into a studio and you're sitting alongside Anthony Daly or Jackie Tyrrell or Donal O'Cusick. And, you know, they've all treated me so well and were so welcoming last year, because it was quite daunting going into that environment. And look, I had a small bit of experience doing it with the Camogie, working on the finals. But coming into the environment of working on and analysing men's games is a different kettle of fish. And obviously there'll be people who'll always make comments of, oh, token female or whatever. But I don't really pay heed to it. And my attitude is if I can talk about hurling, why can't Cyril Farrell talk about Camogie? You know, it should be just accepted that way. And I just want to be considered a good analyst. I don't want to be considered a good analyst for a woman. It should be just equal across the board. And it's, as I said, huge work involved in it, but I'm really enjoying it and, you know, roll on this year, and hopefully we'll have another great championship.
The hurling this year, while we're on it, like, again, it's one of those things which is great that you don't really know what's going to happen at the end of it. Like, you can't predict, like, you can't even really say, like, is there a top four? Is there a top six? Like, it's just like it's wide open again. So this year, who are you looking forward to?
Davy, they're going to win it.
Wexford. Look, and the thing is, as you said, Marie, even to get out of Leinster or Munster championship, like, no one would have expected that Galway wouldn't have got out of the Leinster championship this year, you know, or Waterford would have been knocked out. So, look, I'm hoping for a really positive year with Wexford again. Davy has done huge work, and I think it was crucial that he stayed on with the lads, because I think he has unfinished business. Look, they weren't too far away from beating Tipperary last year, but look, he'll know that there's not, you know, trying to get out of Leinster is going to be tough enough. And really, any team could win it. There's seven or eight teams that could really get there, but I'm still going to be a little bit biased and think Wexford are not too far away.
Well, you have a couple of good Claremen in there, so you know anything could happen.
There you go.
Look, Ursula, thanks so much for coming in. A great Camogie player, and I have to say, great company too, so you'll have to come back to us.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let's take a quick break.
Welcome back to Game On. We're delighted to be joined by Stephen Higgins from CrossCourtView.com. Stephen, the Australia Open well and truly into full swing now. When we were chatting before, there was concerns about the weather. How's that all been?
Well, we've been very lucky in a sense that what Melbourne needed was some rain to come in and wash away the smoke that had enveloped the city. And that's exactly what we got. Of course, the issue with that in terms of tennis is the play is washed out. So on Monday, there was heavy rain from the afternoon on. All the outside courts were cancelled. But the good thing is it cleared up the air quality. And on Tuesday, they had a massive bumper day where they had to make up all the matches. But they're now on schedule and the weather looks pretty good going into the weekend.
But Stephen, you were saying some of the athletes, tennis players, were struggling with breathing. No problem there, no?
Yeah, we haven't heard any issue yet since. There was a player in qualifying, Jakubovic, who had a coughing fit on the court and had to retire. And other players like Bernard Tomic and Jeannie Bouchard were complaining about issues when they're on court. Then there was some, you know, questions about whether Federer and Nadal, with all their status, should be making more of a point of it. But from Monday on, basically, we haven't heard any issues about that.
You think if one of them loses, they'll bring it up?
Well, actually, I think the bigger concern for people like, say, Djokovic and Nadal is the new ATP Cup competition that they played in January. In the first week of January, which was very intense, the team competition, and Serbia and Spain were in the final. And one thing to look for into the second week is whether fatigue will be an issue, particularly for two of them.
So where are we now? Give us the overall picture of who's in, who's out, any big shocks?
Well, actually, it's strange because usually you'd be coming in and saying, you know, this top 10 player lost and all. But on the women's side, all 10 of the top 10 seeds are there and 9 of the top 10 men. The only one to go out was Matteo Berrettini, who made it to the ATP Finals last year. All the big players look good. Djokovic, Nadal, Federer look very good. Serena's look pretty good. Halep and Pliskova and all, they're all going through. So in some ways, there isn't news necessarily on the big seeding. However, the biggest casualty in name recognition is probably Maria Sharapova, who went out in the first round, which is her third first round loss in a row.
I wonder why that is.
There's a combination of factors with her. Like, I mean, she's approaching 33 now. She's struggling with shoulder issues. She hasn't really returned to any sort of form since her drug ban. And that was
for Meldonium.
Meldonium, yeah. So it was initially a 2-year ban. It was reduced down to, I think, 18 months. But she was asked whether she'd be returning to Melbourne next year, and she wasn't sure. I wonder, given she's been out in the tour so long, and because of her loss now, she's going to drop down to about 360 in the rankings. Will she keep going? Like, why would she bother, in a sense?
So she took the Meldonium and for a heart condition, and then
It was a medication that was aimed at people older, I think pensioners or so, who had heart problems. She took it. It was stricken off WADA's record, and she kept taking it about a month or two into it. Her and her team claimed they didn't know about it, but there was a lot of controversy about, you know, why she was taking it. And I think something that really hurt her was her attitude when she came back was kind of blaming everyone else about it, as opposed to just taking...
Somebody should have told me that it was on the ban list.
I think that didn't endear her to people generally. And she has a core support of fans, obviously, because she's been such a superstar in the sport for years. But I don't know how much sympathy there was, and it hasn't really grown. And she's really struggled since. Like, she hasn't been kind of half the player that she was before.
Do you think we're going to see the end of her soon?
I would kind of be thinking, I wouldn't be surprised if she quit this year, because for a player who's been world number one and been in the top 10 for so long to be struggling around trying to qualify, needing wild cards, that's not a recipe for, you know, enjoyment of the sport.
Tennis must be happy enough, though, that there are new stars coming through. So Coco Gauff being one that is fresh in everyone's mind. And again, she's looks like she could have a big one now against Naomi Osaka.
Yeah, I'd say that's the most exciting match for people to follow that's coming up. In the third round, Coco Gauff will play Naomi Osaka. They played in the US Open last year. It was kind of a blowout win for Osaka. But people might remember it from a lovely moment at the end where Gauff was in tears and Osaka consoled her, did the interview with her on court, and it was kind of like a nice sign of camaraderie. She's a really exciting talent. I mean, she's still so young and she's getting lots of pressure because she's doing well, but you worry about too much too soon, and she has so much time. Like, you just don't want her to be like, oh, she's Serena Williams or she's whoever, like, immediately.
Stephen,
in your view, has she improved from last year?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's really exceptional is her maturity. I mean, obviously athleticism's great, and, you know, she's really good ground strokes and all, but the way she can keep herself going, like, she went down, lost the first set in the second round, but recovered and kind of figured out her game. The encore coaching isn't allowed at the Grand Slams, so, you know, she has to figure out the situation herself. And the maturity for someone who's 15 going on to 16, I mean, there's players who are 29 who are nowhere near that mature. I mean, just thinking of someone like Fabio Fognini or something, for instance. But I think the maturity allied with the athleticism and the strokes will just shoot her up the rankings.
Serena Williams, is she able to, do you think, get one?
I was watching her today. The serve is still good. It's still getting out of trouble. There might be an issue. She's due to play Osaka if she gets through, and they both get through. And it's just if they get into long extended rallies and all. She is playing probably better than she has since pregnancy, maybe the best she's played since pregnancy. But the thing is, they're all so good. Like, you know, I mean, when she played in those finals against Andreescu and Osaka and Halep, they're all so good now. They're not going to give it to you. They're going to, you know, do everything they can. And when you get into those extended rallies, that's when it really tests out the movement and coming in out of corners and all.
Do you think she's just going to go for one more and then done?
Well, I think she wants the 25, but the 24 is such a kind of...
Significant.
Well, it's such a significant goal, but it's been hanging on her now for ages now, into four Grand Slam finals. If her serve is excellent, that can keep her going and get her through into well into the second week. But the thing is, if she plays against people like Osaka and Halep and all, where they know how to beat her and their athleticism outstanding, that's the real challenge for her.
She's been frustrated though. Her error rate is high, isn't it?
Yeah, well, like say for instance in her match there, I was watching, the forehand was an issue, and that's often, like, her backhand has always been her most solid shot along with the serve. Her forehand is devastating, but it can also go off a bit. The thing that in the four finals that she lost was she started to panic in the first set. She got off to a really bad start and then couldn't recover. And what we'll have to see is if she does get to play Osaka, and Osaka's looking very good, and you know, she's the defending champion, she's won two majors, she knows how to do it, and she knows how to beat Serena. Will she have her A game playing someone like Osaka from the start, you know, getting in all the serves that she needs and rallying consistently and competitively with someone of that quality?
What about the men's? Who are you expecting to meet? Who's on a collision course?
Well, the ones, Federer and Djokovic, are on a collision course in the semis, and the way they've both started, Federer actually had a tricky draw, but loads of seeds have lost, or loads of, like, the seeds lower down have lost, so he actually has a really good run to get there. Djokovic, it's his favourite tournament, and where he's 7-time champion, he looks really good. In the top half, Nadal should get there, but it's tricky. I do think there'll be a break in terms of Daniil Medvedev, who was the US Open finalist and lost to Nadal in five sets. I think he'll break through. I would leave out an option for people like Tsitsipas possibly and Medvedev. One thing to bear in mind is Nadal is scheduled to meet Kyrgios, and he doesn't like playing Kyrgios, and he's lost him at Wimbledon. He's lost him 3 times.
Why doesn't he like playing him?
Because Kyrgios gives you no rhythm, and obviously his brand of tennis is crazy because sometimes he doesn't know what he's doing. But what's interesting is he has a psychologist.
Sounds like us, Donegan.
Yeah, he throws a racket at you.
Yeah, he has a psychologist. He's very calm, and he has the entire country behind him because of his great efforts for the bushfire relief. And he's not the kind of player you want to play in the third round, particularly someone like Nadal, who is prone to being blown off the court. That's the way he'll lose, is he sometimes plays big hitters and he can't compete.
Yeah, just Stephen, looking at it, Olympic year, and you mentioned fatigue levels. Do you think the top players are going to kind of pace themselves a bit more? Like, are everyone like this Australian Open? Are they going for it?
Well, so there is a little bit of a break after Australian Open before you get to the big Master Series in Indian Wells and Miami in March. And then you've got the juggernaut clay court swing, which often, you know, Nadal obviously does so well, but it means it affects the rest of his year. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, Federer is the king of scheduling properly. It will be interesting to see, from because they started with such an intense first week, will that cause issues then in the Australian Open and then leading into March? With the women's side, they didn't have the ATP Cup, which is a bonus in a sense, so it's kind of more of a standard season for them.
Okay, well, we look forward to the next couple of weeks of discussing everything that is happening in the Australian Open. Stephen Higgins of Cross Court View, thank you very much for joining us. Now, Man United kick off against Burnley at 8:15, but in tonight's other two matches, it's 1-0 to Leicester against West Ham, while it's still scoreless between Spurs and Norwich. And that is all we have time for tonight. Tara Stewart is up next.
Game on 2FM. Weekdays from 6.